Okay. I want to thank everyone for coming. My name is Eric Malafeu. I'm from Harmonix Music Systems. We've made some PS2 games, Frequency and Amplitude, Karaoke Revolution, and iToy Antigrav. Supposed to remind you all to turn off your cell phones and remember to fill out your evaluation forms. So we're here to talk about data-driven programming. And what that means is that you've got separate data from code and that your data drives your program's logic. To us, this means parameterizing your algorithms all the way through scripting. And the benefits of data-driven programming are that you can change your data without recompiling your program. In many cases, you can just change it without rerunning your program, so you can see the effect of your changes faster. It also opens up your program to designers who can edit the text files as well as any programmer can. And it exposes the functionality to yourself, so even if you're a programmer, it's great to see how your program can be driven. We found that it increases the reusability of our C++ systems. This is by putting game-specific dependencies into data and script. And it also enables certain types of programming that we can't do otherwise, like message passing and RPC and tasking. So we developed our own system to work with data and script. Sort of evolved over a period of 5 years and 4 games. When you get a look at it, you'll notice that it's got a striking similarity to Lisp, but it started out without any inkling of Lisp, and it's quite different at a low level. You could describe our system as a data format with a programming interface and an integrated scripting engine. And the implementation is very, very sparse. As a matter of fact, I hope to explain every bit of it here today. 70K, although that includes 40K of just built-in functions, so really at its core it's tiny. But it is the most widely used library in our code. It's so widely used, we sort of treat it as a data, a language extension. But before we developed our own data system, we had to take a false step. In our first game, we had a sort of ill-defined need for data and scripting, and we thought, Python's embeddable, Python's a great scripting language, let's embed Python. What we found out was that it really had too much overhead and indirection for our needs. For instance, if you just wanted to get a piece of data, like an integer from a name, in our code we translated that token to a command string which had to be interpreted, which called a Python function to return a Python integer which would get converted back to an integer. And what you really want to do is go straight from the token to an integer. Also, we had to wrap Python, and that's just another way of saying there were many levels of code you had to get through as well to get input and output from the system. And finally, it took about 3 megabytes code plus our data, and that was pretty extreme on a 32 meg console. So we were aiming for a lower overhead system. My talk will be broken up into these sections. First, we'll talk about working with data, how we specify data and use it without any reference to scripting. And then we'll see why, or how actually, we had to incorporate scripting and how that was good, but it didn't replace our data needs. And then I think a very interesting part of the talk is how we're able to seamlessly integrate our data and scripting with our C++ and move back and forth between them with a couple of mechanisms. And finally, I'll talk about some things we can do with scripting that we just had a hard time doing with C++. So the first thing about our system to describe is the data format. And basically, it's arrays of loosely typed nodes. The nodes can be assigned to any of these types, subarrays, integers, floats, strings, and they can be reassigned as well. And we store them in arrays rather than lists. Generally, we get our data by loading it from file, parsing it from text, but we also create it on the fly for many cases. So here's an example data file. You'll notice that information is structured and values are annotated, which is great for editing. When someone wants to add a price or calories, they don't care about the order that it's in the structure. They don't care if fruit and cereal comes before bacon and eggs. So our code shouldn't either. XML is another way of representing structured data in a text file, but to us it was pretty wordy, and I think you lose a lot of the readability. Of course, everyone uses an XML editor, but as you'll see, we added features to our system, and we didn't want to continually have a customized editor to be able to edit it. Another way of representing that data is just sort of in a flat, non-structured way. And this might be fine when you serialize your information and read it back in, but it's not great for human editing. There's no contextual clues. The memory representation of our data arrays is like this. There are 16 bytes per array and 8 bytes per node. Nodes just represent a value, which is a union, and a type. And then also in the data array, we know how many nodes we have. We keep track of a file and line for each data array for debugging, and a reference count for memory management. So we're able to represent data with just about two, you know, some factor over two times its minimal representation. And I'll also mention now we can serialize this to back out to text files or into and from binary formats. Here's an example of our C++ code reading that file. Notice that we read it into an array. And if we want the price, we would do it by searching through each level of the data from the top. So here we're searching the first level of arrays for the eggs tag and then for the array beginning with price, and then we're getting its data back as a float. It's important that we have to ask for what type of data we want, because if we specify the wrong type in code or if they type in the wrong type of value in the data file, we'll get an error message. So, for instance, if we tried to access price as a wrong type here, it would tell us that it's not an integer and give us a file in line. Now, for things that have reference count, like arrays and strings we allocate on a heap, nodes act as smart pointers, so they increase and decrease the reference counts to the things they point to. And that's largely how we manage our memory. There's no garbage collection. The only thing you have to remember is when we create our arrays to release them. Here's an example of that. Notice that we assign the nodes just to values directly. Data nodes have constructors for every type they can represent. And when we embed the price array into the eggs array, there's a ref count added to price. So when we release it, it's still around. Now, in those examples and in future examples, you'll see me using a lot of strings. But realize that most of the time those aren't allocated strings. They're what we call symbols, which is a Lisp concept of a unique permanent string. So It's permanent, and that's the first time we come across one. We allocate space for it, and it never goes away. And it's unique. Two symbols won't have the same character strings. So this allows symbols to be pointers to those strings for fast comparisons, and it saves memory for multiple instances of those symbols. We still need heap strings to represent like generated or truly unique strings that we don't want to put in our pre-allocated table. A comment about searching through arrays is we make the first element of an array a symbol, which we call a tag, and then searching through it is just a linear search of pointer comparisons, so it's pretty fast. But when we need more speed, we can sort those subarrays by their pointers and do a binary search on them. So that makes it very fast, and is one of the reasons that we use arrays rather than lists. A couple of other things that you'll find in a data file, comments, macros, directives, like these C++ ones. I just want to describe how our macros are a little different than C++. For one, they're persistent outside the file. So if we create it in one file, it's defined until we undefine it somewhere. And macros are terrific for multiply referencing arrays rather than copying them. So if a macro contains an array, it gets expanded, and it just adds reference counts to that same array. Here's an example of a simple macro, a non-scalar macro, and one use we have for referencing arrays. Another operation that we do on our data files that has been great for us is merging, which is sort of like a special include that recursively goes through two files, finds their matching subarrays, and adds arrays from the merge file if it's not fully specified in the original file. So an example here of an original array merged with the second array results in the new subarrays from the merge array and the original leaf nodes of the original. So when you ship your game, you're not going to want to read or parse your text data if you have a lot of it. You actually want to serialize it into a binary format and read it faster that way. But it isn't as easy as it sounds for us because of our special macros and things like ifdef. Macros have the persistence, and macros can also be referential of other macros, so their load environment is important. So when you load them that first time, you can't expand them. Same goes for ifdef. It has an environment-dependent behavior on load, so when you're loading to then be serialized into a data file, you don't want to process your ifdefs. The main use we have for this data is configuring our code. Whenever any piece of code has a need for data, structured data or simple data, we throw it into a config file. Actually, multiple config files, because you can imagine there's a lot of it that get included into one config file. And we load that at program start time and just make it accessible to anyone, so it's like a database. The overhead for our data is typically 1 or 200K compared to the 2 megs we were spending for equivalent Python data. And a note about this, when you cache, make sure to encrypt it because players can read your data off disk. We got our game sheets mailed to us after shipping Amplitude because we didn't encrypt our file. Fortunately, that didn't ruin anyone's experience. Here's an example configuration file where we give some parameters to a renderer and our memory manager. I say it's a default configuration file because you're bound to have multiple applications that use a library and its data. And the way you want to handle those, to customize data for those, is to just specify the things that you want to override rather than copying the entire data file and tweaking the parts you want. So we merge in the default data file with these overrides to get the final file. This keeps it maintainable when we need to add parameters or change their default values. I mentioned before that we can change our data and on the fly if we plan ahead. In some cases, we do that by reloading a portion of the database and telling the code that depends on it that it changed to and refresh themselves. What's important here is that you've got your parameters grouped by the code that uses it. So it's sort of bad form to read other people's data, although the global database makes that possible. Something else we do to modify parameters at runtime is just change them directly in database memory. So this is an interactive interface to cycle through parameters and change their values. And we provide a little extra information to our parameters that the program doesn't need, but the editor finds useful, like range of values or step size to change and a readable description. After changing these values in memory, there's a question of how to save it back out to the config file. Sometimes we just copy the values down and edit them back into that file, but if you have structured your config file so these parameters are in their own subfile, you could save them back out programmatically. And that's how we use data. But we found a couple of systems really pushing the limits of what we could represent in data. We had a world system that tried to match conditions with actions. We had a cheat system that matched button combos to cheat events. And we had a user interface system that had to do things when changing highlight states or selecting objects. And in all the cases, we built these pretty complex systems for handling data that really was just too fragile or limited, and that we wanted to generalize and really decode that we could specify a runtime. Scripting then gives you total control of your program flow, but it doesn't have the advantage of brevity or conciseness that data does, so we're careful when we use scripting. And we figured out how to combine scripting into our data system without overriding the data. You can mix it and match it with data. Here's an example of specifying script inside of a data structure. Here's an object with a regular height parameter and a collision response. Play sound effect, add points to the game. Notice that our script commands are in these curly braces rather than parentheses. We can turn that around and specify complex data within our script calls. So here's a sort of made-up example where we're specifying annotated data to set up player. And a more actual example of a launchpad object that has a runover handler that tells the object that ran over it to go into flight mode with a couple of parameters. And the great thing here is usually you've got to extract your data from your C code. Everyone tells you not to hard code it. But when you're writing script, you should hard code it. You just put the values you want in your script code because you're already in data land. The uses that we have for scripting are varied. We, of course, use it to handle events, mostly in our user interface systems and in our world level systems. We have a couple of custom tools for artists to work with our modeling and level files, and we found scripting useful to provide them with plugins, so when they have like one-off needs, we have our own little Mac script equivalent. It also automatically gives us a command console, so at any point during the game you can pop it up and type in a script command to be evaluated. And a new use we found for it that we didn't plan at the outset was remote level editing, which I'll show you on the next slide. And we found it completely replaced our C++ messaging system, which was a happy accident as well. Here's remote level editing. We'll load a level into both the game and an editor. The game's got an interface meant for playing, and oftentimes runs on a console, so it's not appropriate to embed an editing interface into it. So we'll have a separate editor, and for those things we can't see in the editor that really require game engine feedback, we will serialize change information into script calls and send it down a wire. So all we're doing here is creating script calls that are serialized and interpreted on the other end, just like remote procedure calls. Commands look like have two forms. We have function commands and object commands. The commands are just data arrays, but they're a different type, so the node knows that they're not dumb data. Here's a couple of examples of commands. The first one is a function, an if statement that will look at its first argument and decide whether to execute its subsequent arguments. Here's an object call that sets up a clear color for our renderer. Does anybody know what RGB110 is? And the last example is adding points to our game based on an object worth. Executing function command from C++ looks like this. We'll access the command and call execute on it. What this does internally is it finds the C++ handler that was registered with that function name. And then it calls it with the actual command array. It doesn't do any evaluation on its arguments, like most interpreters have to recursively evaluate their arguments, put the result into a temporary list, have special ways of avoiding interpretation of arguments, like for if statements. Instead, we leave all that up to the handler in a natural way. Here's an example of a function handler. This just adds two integers together. Notice that we access the first argument of the command array at offset 1 because the zeroth slot is going to be our plus symbol. And all we would do to add this function to the system is call this register function. And notice this returns a node. So in this case, it's going to be an integer node. So here's our little trick for argument evaluation, which is that when you try to access a node by a type other than command, and it is a command, it'll execute automatically. And then what you get is its return value. This is a little less flexible and correct than sort of the Lisp style of evaluation. But we found it a worthwhile trade-off. There's only really been a few cases where we had to be cognizant of it. Another more comments on scripting are that it only specifies the syntax for calling functions and objects. There's no implicit language or keywords in the system, except those that we just choose to register all the time. And since everyone's going to use it, you should make sure that everyone agrees on the names and functionality of those things. It's a constant source of flaming for us. There's an important optimization, which is that we don't always look up the function node to find its handler. On the first time we execute it, we actually bind that handler to the node, so nodes can point to functions as well. That's safe because we know that pointer's never going to go away. It's a pointer to a function. But if it does get re-registered, then you'd have to reload the script. You've got to have some way of documenting your script hooks. It might be possible to generate it, but we keep a very lightweight file around just describing the syntax of every command and global variable. Otherwise, you'll have no way of finding your script hooks. There's no headers to to pour through. And a last note here is that we don't do anything special when parsing commands. We just load them up into these arrays and call them command types instead of regular array types and leave everything else up to runtime. You don't get very far with scripting without variables. We implement them using globally named data nodes, and then variable nodes are just pointers to those. And just like commands, they're automatically evaluated when accessed as something else. And their evaluation is just a dereference, so they're extremely fast. Here's a couple of examples. A benefit of using sort of globally named variables is they're accessible from C++. So here's where we are assigning a value to one and then using it in script. We can also assign it in script and use it in C++. And to offset the cost of looking up these variables, we usually store them into statics or member variables. We do have a need for local variables, but we don't do what's called lexical scoping, which is sort of correct scoping of local variables. Instead, we implement dynamic scoping, which is just pushing the variable and its value onto a stack and then using it however we want to and then restoring that value from the stack. This means that functions you call are going to have access to your variable unless they're good about defining local variables, they could override it or use it accidentally. But that again is a trade-off that we intentionally made to keep the system simple. Here's the script function we use to utilize our local variables. It specifies a list of variables that get pushed onto the stack, and then the code inside it gets executed, and it's free to modify those values, and then when it's done, it restores the values from the stack. This, by the way, is similar to Lisp's let. So that's how our function commands work, but most people's programs are full of objects, C++ objects, and so we wanted a very easy way to call those, and looking at Lisp's object system was completely inappropriate. So here's how we process an object command. We find it by its name, and then we pass the command array to a virtual handle function on it, which can be implemented in any way. This just shows the spareness of our data object class. It just has a pointer to a name for lookup and an interface. We also find it useful to give objects no names, in which case they have to be bound directly to nodes or variables, so they can also point to data objects. There's a few examples of calling objects, telling something to grow, telling a variable object to change its speed. We evaluate the first argument in a command. So it itself can be the result of a function. Here we're asking for the nearest object to a bomb and telling it to get hurt. And all of the materials in our system are data objects as well. So here's an example of iterating through materials and maybe setting their values. To implement the handle interface, we use a C++ macro language that looks something like MFC if you've done that. Usually we just match methods to, method names to methods on the data object. We can also just handle them in place for simple accessors. We can forward commands to multiple superclasses or delegate objects. And we can perform a check that our handler got or our method was handled. So just to be clear, this set of macros here actually defines the handle function or method in a CPP file. Here's an example of a C++ object handler for that grow call. Notice that its argument offset begins at 2 because there's an object and a method name in slots 0 and 1. And that it also returns a data node. Alternately, we'll just call an existing C++ method from our handlers. So we can have the same functionality available from C++ as script. And that's it for our script support. That's the basic data system in a nutshell. But to really like tap into the power of this, we developed a few other constructs, and we'll show you those. So we've showed you how scripts can call on C++. The first step is to make scripts able to call other scripts. We do that by defining script-side functions like this. This func call makes a function called add1 that just adds 1 to its argument. And the way this is implemented is as a data object called add1, whose handle executes its body after assigning its arguments. So here's our very lean implementation of a data func object. There's no special preprocessing. Everything is done on the fly. So the next thing we want to do is be able to call script handlers. So here's a couple of handlers assigned to a dude object. And what happens when he gets hit or gets missed by something. Now, we'll associate this list of handlers with a C++ object through a data class whose handle function looks up the method name and executes it like a script function. One wrinkle to this is you want to have a this variable to be able to call handlers back on yourself. And that this variable needs to be assigned after you evaluate your arguments, because the previous this value might be in your arguments. Here's something we do with macros, is to essentially subclass our script handlers by defining common handlers in a macro and then expanding it into multiple objects. So here is an example of a couple of objects getting a free miss handler and an internal hit method they can call. A couple more things about data class are that it supports instance parameters. So you can use it to represent a real class. We would set them from C++ and can set and get them from script as well. And these go into a data array that is not as structured. It's a lot like a Perl dictionary with key value, key value, key value. And this does enable entirely script-side class definitions in instancing, but we generally don't go that far with it. We instead use data class on our actual C++ object to mix and match script handlers with C++ handlers. So now we have the ability to put our handlers in either C++ or script. But we've only talked about calling them from script. And to fully generalize the system, we want to be able to call them from C++ as well. This entails making a command array to pass to the handle function. And we use a message class to do that easily. We have message classes that take up to like 7 data nodes. Notice that the command array it generates has nothing in its object slot. We're not actually going to interpret this. We're calling it directly on an object we've already got. can specialize that methods class to constrain its C++ interface, so you don't have to worry about the offsets of arguments. Here's an example of specializing that previous message and using it by just providing the arguments it has, and you can get information out of this from a nice C interface. So when you've got your specialized messages, you can do a few things differently to handle them. For one thing, you can define your object handlers to accept that message. And you'll notice here that we're not using or referencing data arrays directly anymore. And here's where we realized that we didn't need a C++ messaging system, or that the one we had was entirely redundant as far as having a base class that could be identified and routed by type, and an entirely separate routing macro language. So messages are just packaged script calls. To handle these specialized messages on the script side, we generally make macros to correspond with their name and the argument order. This lets us add arguments or change their order, or even change the type of the name without breaking all of our script code. We'll just edit the macro that corresponds with the message. So final note about choosing to use C++ and script handlers. We can go back and forth between them easily in our data class, but you want to use script handlers if you need the runtime flexibility. They're also useful for prototyping, sort of while you're running a program, but you want to make sure to turn that back into C++. We also use script handlers to avoid dependencies that we don't want in a certain layer. For instance, our level system doesn't want to depend on a particular game mechanic, so we let its event handlers have that dependency. And finally, this has allowed us to reduce the number of C++ subclasses we need for functionality immensely. But you'll still want to use C++ handlers to do specialized argument handling. For instance, passing variables in for setting rather than evaluating. Or a polymorphic handler. Our actual add function does different things when it's given two ints, or an int and a float. And it's also easier to handle a variable argument lists from C++. And of course, you'll get better performance and be able to maintain it better if it's in C++. So a couple more comments about using our scripting. A very powerful thing, concept is tasks. So these are commands that we want to execute over time rather than right now. We'll either want to delay the script processing or execute something on every poll until it's done. First example is delaying something for a period of 100. We tell something called a task manager or a scheduler about these tasks. The next example is just interpolating a variable from a start and end value and calling an arbitrary script that uses that variable. Another use we have is to do sort of threaded tasks that don't execute all at once. This example will start a character walking to a point and then wait for it together before it continues. So it's a lot like a C++ thread that we just implement with script. A wrinkle on tasks. If they use variables in their commands, those have to be preserved from construction time to when they're actually used. So Lisp would do this pretty cleanly with closures. We do it by explicitly calling those variables out and then storing them like dynamic scoping and restoring them for each each time we call the command. So here's an example of delaying a message call for 100. And the last thing I have to say about scripting is that we generally debug it using print statements, although there's nothing really getting in the way of doing an interactive debugger. And it's been very useful for us to dump the script stack on an assert in addition to a C++ stack, so you can see the number of calls that started from script before the error happened. And that's what I have for you today. I hope that this has helped you think about your data system needs and designs. I'll make these slides available on our website after the conference. And thank you all for letting me talk about this. Any questions? Yes? That's a good idea. The question is who generally edits the script files? And it's usually programmers. When we're able to describe the functionality of a system entirely in data, then our designers will get into it and do modifications. But when it has to turn into script, generally programmers do it. Although we found a lot of designers and artists were very interested in getting into it and doing it themselves. Yeah?
You don't have a compilation step, but do you have any sort of validation?
Good question also, which is, do we validate our data or scripting before we attempt to run it? And the answer is no. XML, notably, has that ability through its schemas and DTDs. One reason we haven't found the need for it is that we generally parse our program parameters at load time, so if there's a mistake in any of those parameters, we find out right at program start. And implementing something like a schema for a scripting language would definitely be more effort than it's probably worth. Yes?
How much of the scripting do you have in your
games? I looked at our user interface system and how it had evolved from 100% C++, and the ratios came out to be about around 30% of lines of data or script are in script. Yep. Oh, certainly. Yeah, all these data files go into source control. I'm sorry. The answer was, do we source control all these scripts? Yes. Yeah, the question is, do we find a need to search through our data? And I'm a big fan of writing Perl search and replace scripts to trivially change function names. So something that's helped that is to give our data files a unique extension, like DTA rather than text, so that when you write big batch scripts, they can focus on your data files. Any more questions? Yes? In script we do. Although in data we have load time branching available through ifdef functionality. In script we support ifs and if-elses and switch and conditions and all the usual things. Any more questions? Yes? So the question is, how complex do these scripts grow? And the answer is, we try not to let them grow too big. Complex code is best handled in C++, and when we find that our scripts are getting hairy, we'll take a piece out of it, we'll just factor out the stuff that should go into C++ and make that a separate handler. A useful case study, it was We did a lot of prototype code in script. While that can make your project turnaround times very short, if you don't get around to actually doing the refactoring, you're left with a bunch of unmaintainable script code. Anybody else? Yes?
So what was the biggest script file you had? Thousands of lines or hundreds of lines?
Okay. It would be hundreds. I'm sorry, the question was, how big in terms of numbers of lines do our script files generally get? So let's say we've got a data file describing an object, an entire object with a bunch of handlers. That would typically be no more than 100 or a couple hundred lines. Although we use raw data to represent some very large things like credits. We have 1 million people to thank. And localization tables. So all of our localization tokens are stored into data files that match symbol to string. Those can be thousands of ones. All right. Well, again, thank you all for coming and enjoy the rest of the conference.